Hey everyone, welcome back to Strange New Worlds, a science and Star Trek podcast. I'm your host, Mike Wong. Last time on Strange New Worlds, we spoke to Professor Paul Rimmer from the University of Cambridge. I asked him about the origin of life scene in Star Trek TNG's finale, whether it was an accurate description of what scientists think may have occurred at the origin of life on Earth. He said, "Not really," and reimagined a better version of that scene. Today, I got to ask another Origins of Life scientist, Dr. Stuart Bartlett, about that very same scene. He also thinks that scene is a poor representation of what actually occurred at life's beginnings, but for completely different reasons. Stuart also helps us reimagine that scene in a totally different way. And I think that's so interesting, because it's reflective of, one, how ignorant we really are about life's origins, and two, how creative and diverse scientific approaches are to trying to understand it. Today's guest, Stuart Bartlett, is a complexity scientist, astrobiologist, and artificial life researcher at Caltech, and he's an affiliate of the SETI Institute. He and I are good friends and close collaborators. One of our most famous papers was about a process-based definition of LYFE, L-Y-F-E, which you can hear more about on episode 102 of Strange New Worlds. And Stuart himself has been a guest on this show numerous times before. Most recently, we heard from him in episode 129, where he told us about how he's developing techniques to use complexity to seek out new life and new civilizations. On today's show, we talked to Stuart about learning and life, how information processing has been at the core of what life does, from its emergence 4 billion years ago to artificial intelligence today. Along the way, we're going to talk about two papers of his, one that he wrote with a colleague from France, the other he wrote with me. Ready? Engage. Stuart Bartlett, it's so great to have you back on Strange New Worlds, a science and Star Trek podcast.
It's lovely to be here, Mike.
Last time you were on, I believe we discussed your planetary complexity biosignatures paper, which made a really big splash. That was published in Nature Astronomy, and I know you've taken off and, you know, really run with that idea full force. You have a whole group of students and colleagues working on expanding this idea of complexity-based biosignatures. A lot of that work is still in progress. You gave a wonderful talk at Carnegie and visited here last week talking about that. But because it is still work in progress, I think we'll save the biosignatures aspect for our next discussion and focus today on a couple of papers published. When was it? 2022? is that right?
Provenance of LYFE was 2022.
Right.
And Genesity was 2022, I guess, as well. Yeah.
What is time? Who knows?
It's a fluid, right?
Yeah. So to dive into our subject today, which I think the overarching theme is going to be learning and life, I want to go back all the way to life's humble beginnings and what we imagine happened at the origin of life. And luckily, Star Trek tells us the answer, right? So in the Next Generation episode, All Good Things, Q snaps his finger, takes Picard back to the early Earth to witness the origin of life, or actually not to witness it because there's this weird space-time anomaly that gets in the way. But basically, Q describes what should have happened at the origin of life were it to have been witnessed by Q and Picard. And he says, a group of amino acids are about to combine to form the first protein, the building blocks of what you call life. So, Stuart, for you as an astrobiologist, as an origins of life scientist, is this picture of amino acids joining together as building blocks the process that you picture in your mind when you envision what occurred at the origin of life?
The short answer is not really no. I think it's probably more interesting and more mysterious than that in various ways. I think probably they were inspired to a certain extent by Darwin's warm little pond idea, that you have a prebiotic soup, like a broth, and if you cook the broth long enough, you'll get some semblance of biological molecules which can then somehow bootstrap themselves towards a first cell. Straight away, there's a little technical issue, which, to be fair, they probably wouldn't have been aware of in the early 90s or even the late 80s when that show was written. So they would have known, presumably, about the Miller-Urey experiment, which produces abundant amino acids. So they probably were aware that amino acids are quite common in meteorites and in reducing experiments in early Earth environments. But a lot of the experiments since the Miller-Urey experiment, and obviously with greater detail in more recent decades, have shown that it's very difficult to polymerize amino acids beyond like dipeptides, sort of longer chains of amino acids. They do not spontaneously form because it's thermodynamically unfavorable. You're in a high water activity environment, and those polymers prefer to break apart rather than form together. And the premise of that scene is that the foundation of life is particular types of molecules. We tend to think that life's molecular components are amino acids, nucleic acids, lipids and sugars, plus some others and some inorganics. But as we know from various experiments, you can provide the precursors or the small components of those molecules and energize them in all kinds of different ways, and they do not make life, at least on the timescales of the experiments that have been done. And so I guess the slightly more modern version of that is the hypothesis that if you can synthesize the molecular precursors, such as amino acids and nucleic acid bases and so forth, simultaneously with things like lipids and sugars and so forth, that certain physical forces might conspire to produce a very, very elementary sort of protocell with some basic replication cycle. And in general, the field tries to, like, the target of all these experiments is something which can exhibit Darwinian evolution. And the machinery for Darwinian evolution that we know of in modern life, or in at least going back, let's say, 3 billion years or so, is the genetic code. And so people try to understand the origins of the genetic code, and they can sort of reconstruct the history of the ribosome and so forth to try and figure out where it came from. The challenge is that you can go quite far back with the records, the genetic record or the sort of structural record of metabolism and the ribosome, but then you will always stumble upon this, what we call the event horizon, where either genetic or molecular records basically stop, where, let's say, something like 3.8 to 4 billion years ago, where things were in such a state of flux that, well, we don't know exactly what was happening, but it would have been a fairly chaotic time where whether it was some kind of evolutionary process or something else, the basic function of the first cell was still in the process of sort of condensing out, emerging. And I think it's reasonable to assume that there are no tangible records of those events anywhere to be found, not in the rock record, not in the genetic record, not in metabolism and so forth. So that is a very mysterious period. And in our papers, we've written a lot about what properties of life we expect to be conserved in other forms of life out there away from Earth, and also all the way back to the origin of life. I mean, somewhere there's a transition between physical and chemical processes to more biological processes. And, you know, in all of our discussions over these years, we keep coming back to this property of learning and information processing, so which would include the basic Darwinian evolution in the prebiotic systems. But again, that target of Darwinian evolution and the genetic code assumes like a primacy for Darwinian evolution, that is the defining feature of life. And that is the defining feature of life in the sense that it's helped us make sense of life since Darwin and Wallace gave us those ideas. But that does not inherently guarantee that it was the relevant driving force going right back to the beginning. I mean, I think it's reasonable to say that like selection is always there, but whether the genetic code was really the primary first emergent property that made life life, in my opinion, is not guaranteed. It tells you how life becomes more adapted to its environment, but I'm not sure it tells you how life began.
Let me just pause here to reinforce what I think is a really critical point that you've raised, which is this target assumption that Darwinian evolution is the defining feature or process or function of life, means that a lot of origin of life research is focused on producing the target molecules that we know participate in Darwinian evolution today, namely DNA and probably RNA, because that's a simpler molecule and probably could have played both the role of an information carrying molecule and a catalyst early on in life. So a lot of origin of life science is targeted towards trying to synthesize RNA out of plausible geochemical scenarios. But what you're trying to say is that there's no guarantee that Darwinian evolution and its associated molecules should be the target at the origin of life because of this fuzzy event horizon before, you know, Darwinian evolution was the way that life operated, or one of the major ways that life updated its quote-unquote knowledge or information about the environment. We don't really know what happened before then. So you kind of want to, in your research program, expand and abstract a little bit away from Darwinian evolution. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment, yeah. I mean, I'm just worried that we are putting all our eggs in one basket. So even though it kind of seems like there's only one basket to put your eggs in, because Darwinian evolution is the foundational theory of biology, I have a suspicion that there are other baskets that we just need to discover them, and then we can start putting eggs in them. And so I guess I want to leave room for the other baskets in case they are good places to put your eggs. And I wonder whether there's potentially an analogy with the development of physics and cosmology. So once we had established like the foundations of quantum mechanics, let's say, and particle physics and relativity, and you could ask the question, does that picture explain where the universe came from? Does it explain the Big Bang? And, you know, the Big Bang was a very extreme situation and potentially requires some exotic physics to explain it. It's hard for us to recreate the conditions of the Big Bang. So, like, the Big Bang and black holes, for example, are good, like, testing grounds for physical theories because they're challenging extreme situations. And I think there's probably some analogy with biology that perhaps evolution by natural selection can explain a lot of life's history, but it may well be that we need either new or additional laws to understand where the evolutionary process came from. I mean, that's another way of phrasing it. Like, does evolution explain its own origins, basically?
Huh.
You know, by something like Gödel's incompleteness theorem, to sort of have one coherent representation scheme, it's always going to lean on another one, and that one is itself going to lean on something else. So it seems a bit confusing to say that evolution is like a complete theory of the biological world. And not only that, but it can explain how biology arose from the non-living world. It can explain the origin of itself.
I really like this analogy, Stuart. It's really striking because, just like we need new physics to understand what happens, you know, around a singularity, especially when the laws of physics as we understand them start to break down, you're suggesting essentially that we need new understanding, new theories to really get at the heart of what happened at the origin of life.
Right, right. Yeah. And of course, my preferred angle is related to information processing and complexity and emergence, which is a growing and exciting field of, let's say, science. It's not specific to one discipline. To me, that's where the theory of everything will have to come from, is that it'll be the theory of complexity and emergence.
So you're looking through a slightly different lens at the origin of life, not trying to understand the synthesis of the first molecules that could have performed Darwinian evolution, but you're looking at how certain chemical systems can exhibit learning behavior. So we're going to talk about this paper that you published in 2022 called Provenance of Life, Chemical Autonomous Agents Surviving Through Associative Learning, which was co-authored with your friend David, who is some kind of amazing science communication slash video game programmer. I definitely want to ask you about that. But before we get to who he is and how that connection came to be, let's just talk about the contents of the paper. So you're showing how primitive chemical systems can perform associative learning. Stuart, what is associative learning?
So associative learning is basically a process by which some system, let's call it an agent, and that's the normal nomenclature, is existing in an environment where there is some level of structure. So associative learning has no relevance or function or use in an environment that's purely noisy, let's say purely random. So if there is an agent and it lives in an environment where there is some structure, some correlations, some predictable features, then associative learning is the process by which those correlations come to be represented in the agent by building a memory of which features of the environment occur together with which others, essentially. So when things co-occur, the agent is able to form a memory, is able to register the fact that those two things have occurred. So, for example, it has sensor A and sensor B, which detects two things. One might be the sun shining, and the other might be the water in the lake heating up. Mm-hmm. And so there must be, at minimum, some form of a memory. I mean, in our case, it's molecules. We have sort of memory molecules. In the case of a brain, it might be the strengths of connections between neurons. And basically, the agent has to have some way to encode the correlation between at least two environmental features in its memory. So it learns to associate one thing with another. In this case, basically, there's a sort of temporal sequence that when sensor A detects the sun, sensor B has detected that the temperature of the lake is rising. And over time, when that keeps happening again and again, and the agent has this mechanism by which it can form a memory that correlates those two things, in the future, when sensor A detects the sun rising, the cognitive agent will, by virtue of this memory that connects the second stimulus of the lake rising in temperature, purely being triggered by the sun shining, will essentially tell the agent, it will indicate to the agent that the temperature of the lake is soon going to warm up. And of course, there's this famous popularization of associative learning by Pavlov's dogs, which is where you you ring a bell and you feed the dogs. And it doesn't take long for, if you keep repeating that, after a while, the dogs build an associative memory of the correlation between the ringing the bell and the food, such that after a while, if you ring the bell and you don't supply the food, they still salivate because they're expecting the food to come along. And that's normally known as classical conditioning. And now, associative learning, of course, underpins a lot of learning in the biosphere, and even a lot of our learning is associative. In fact, even some high-level cognition could be just very, very high-dimensional, complex associative learning.
Okay, so associative learning, building memories, noticing correlations, and then making some kind of useful prediction about the environment with those memories. So can you describe for us now why your simulation of chemical systems, very simple chemical systems, performing associative learning, how does that relate to the origin of life itself?
That's a good question. The difference between the angle that we discussed a minute ago, where evolution by natural selection is assumed to be the driving force that creates the complexity of life. So here we're kind of abandoning that assumption And the challenge, if you're, let's say you're doing origin of life research, your goal is to understand how life comes from a non-living system. And if you make that decision to abandon biological molecules as your target and abandon evolution by natural selection as your target, you're left with a very, very open canvas, and it's not clear how you should even begin. So that's one of the reasons that there's not so much research outside of the primary paradigm, is because you sort of feel like you're adrift and it's difficult to know where to begin. But due to all of the work and discussions that we've had over these years, and our sort of convergent point that learning in one form or another seems to be the most common factor that we can observe in the biological world, you essentially end up saying, well, we've abandoned biological molecules as a constraint. We've abandoned evolution by natural selection as a constraint. What if the target of our experiments and our simulations becomes associative learning instead? In conventional origin of life research, you're trying to figure out the most parsimonious, most likely, simplest way to go from a clearly non-living system to the biological molecules and the phenomena that you think are indicative of life. In our case, our question becomes, what's the simplest system that could generate an associative learning behavior? Our brains are clearly very, very good at associative learning. Our brains evolved over 3.5 plus billion years. Computers are very good at associative learning. They were hand designed by very clever engineers. So the systems that are conventionally studied in associative learning are hugely complex and already the result of a long evolutionary sequence. So we have to obviously go more elementary than that. It turns out that DNA actually is very, very good at performing computation. You can use DNA as like a memory molecule. You can basically build like a Turing universal computational system with DNA. So that's interesting. So this is like, it's a molecule scale associative learning system. But again, we do not want to assume a complex molecule like DNA. I mean, it's fair to say the DNA probably did come in fairly far after the origin of life. And yeah, DNA is already a very complex molecule. So it would seem unlikely to assume that your prebiotic system could produce these large DNA molecules, which could then perform computation. So the knowledge that we have about DNA computation can only help us so much in understanding a possible trajectory from non-life to an associative learning system. So DNA plus maybe some other complex biological-like molecules can do associative learning, but we would want to go to a more elementary level. And since I tend to approach things at a fairly abstract level, where the sort of phenomena comes first and the details are, in my approach, often sort of secondary. So the actual identities of the molecules are something which we decided can come later, once we've established the plausibility of a learning process in a very simple abstract system. So in our case, we don't start with particular types of molecules. We just assume that there are some chemical compounds available. And so we just give them abstract identities, A, B, C, whatever. And then all we assume is that these molecules can exhibit sort of catalytic reactions with one another. And so that is roughly our set of constraints, that if there are some molecules and there's the possibility for some catalytic reactions between the molecules, and assuming there's some learnable structure in the environment in which these molecules exist, what's the minimum complexity of a chemical agent that can still do associative learning? Like, how simple can we get? What's the most elementary sort of minimum set of things?
Right. So you brilliantly showed in your simulations what that simplest system might look like. Now, assuming that that was representative of what may have been happening in some chemical soup, or take your favorite geochemical scenario for the origin of life, if you had to go and revise the scene where Q and Picard are witnessing the origin of life to include this idea of the emergence of learning, what would you have them witness in that pond? What would you have Q say instead of, oh, there go the amino acids, they're linking up to form the building blocks of life?
So I think if I was to redesign that scene, I would have Q take Picard to one little puddle. So Q and Picard are standing there on the prebiotic earth. And Q says, I want to show you something, Picard. And they go to one little pond and is in this sort of pinkish shimmering color. And Q says, look at this. And he shines some light on the pond, maybe some UV light out of his hand or something. And this nice pink color just sort of disappears and it goes back to like a colorless sludge. And then he shines some light on another part of the pond. And again, the color disappears. And he does this a few times and eventually he's just sort of destroyed all this nice pink shimmering brilliance that was previously just happily sitting there in the pond. And then Q says, now I want to show you a different pond, Picard. And they go to another one and it looks on the face of it exactly the same. There's this bright pink sort of shimmering color and it looks kind of nice because we're in this desolate wasteland apart from this nice little pond. And Q says, watch this. So he shines this UV light out of his hand again. And again, the pink stuff starts essentially dying, goes from this nice pink shiny to a sort of colorless and lifeless. And Picard thinks, well, what's going on? He's just showing me the same experiment. Come on, man, get to the punchline. So Q does another UV light shining. And again, this pink stuff starts dying. And Picard is looking at Q thinking, okay, typical Q, he's just wasting my time, taking me on a wild goose chase. I've seen this before. But then the third time, Q shines this light on the pink shimmering puddle. And initially it starts sort of dying back. But then after a while, it sort of gathers itself up and, let's say, moves away, moves to another side of the pond.
Mm.
So then he shines his light again on where the place where it's moved. And again, it dies a little bit, but then it just moves out of the way to a different part of the pond. And Picard realizes, oh, hang on, this is very different to the first pond. The first pond, he could just kill it with his UV beam. But on this one, actually, the pond is responding. The pond is somehow active.
Wow.
And Picard says, what's going on, Q? And Q says, this pond is on its way to life. You see, the first pond was a little bit like life. It was on its way to life, but it just hasn't made it to the sophistication of being able to make sense of and defend itself against threats in its environment.
Mm-hmm.
But this pond, you see, has just enough learning capacity that it can start to recognize that when I shine the UV light, it will be damaged very soon after. And it doesn't know that initially, but after I've given it a couple of exposures, it has learned that UV light is going to be followed by destruction of the molecular integrity of the system. So by the time I shine my UV light the third time, it's built a memory of what's happening. Now, this is an adaptive system. The previous system was non-adaptive and could easily be destroyed. This pond will go on to form life, whereas the first one was destined to remain a bubbling broth of shimmering pink gloop.
Wow, I feel like I have goosebumps right now just imagining that scene. That's a much more powerful scene than the one that they actually produced. So I hope the writers of the latest Star Trek series are listening so that they can hire you to design the next Star Trek Origin of Life scene.
You heard it here first. I mean, even if they don't use it for the first Origin of Life scene, they could use it for exploratory scenes where they're trying to test if a system is alive or not.
Hey, I like that. I like that.
I mean, the Prime Directive might forbid it, but in some situations, you may need to poke and prod a system to see whether it's alive or not.
So in our discussion so far about the origin of life, we've touched a lot upon this idea of needing to learn about one's environment. So it seems like the environment plays a really big role. And indeed, we published a paper in 2022 talking about a new concept called genesity, which is our new word to describe environments that are suitable for or encouraging of origins of life and the continual evolution of life. And we contrast this with the term habitability, which is one of the major research topics of astrobiology. Habitability simply describes the conditions required for the maintenance of life, but we lay out some pretty abstract, but still, I think, concrete ideas for what a genial environment would be. Again, one that is good at generating novelty. So Stuart, could you describe for us what genesity is and what a genial environment looks like?
Genesity, the word itself, we came up with because it has the origin of Genesis, Genesis being sort of creation. So it's like an ability to create life. In conversations about habitability, there are often several themes buried within habitability playing a role simultaneously, but we don't always specify the ones that we're most interested in the midst of those conversations. So one aspect of that is whether we're most interested in life beginning or most interested in life just being maintained. And then the other aspect that people might think about in terms of habitability is an environment where life can evolve. So it's like, can life begin? Can it remain? And can it evolve? Can it become more complex? Can it adapt? And there's potentially overlap between those three. So some of the conditions, I mean, maybe you could have all three in the same set of conditions. So maybe there is a set of conditions where life can begin, it can be maintained, and it can also evolve. But there could also be differences between those two. So for example, in our case, it seems like once we had oxygen in the atmosphere, the rate of evolution was somehow high. Like life really diversified a lot once we had oxygen in the atmosphere. So you could argue that the ability to evolve and diversify and complexify was dramatically enhanced by the presence of oxygen, thereby creating a slight difference between like minimum conditions for maintaining versus minimum conditions for evolving and producing diversity. So we want to think about different sets of conditions for those three processes, starting, maintaining, and evolving life. And we also wanted to generalize away from just liquid water on rocky bodies, because that gives you like a target, a place to look for planets. And no one's been able to come up with an alternative to liquid water as a solvent. I mean, you can suggest things that might work, but it's not as if anyone has built a fully living system which is completely free of water. So it's a reasonable assumption to look for liquid water on a rocky body. But since we've only got one example of life to study, the one example cannot give us any systematic guidance on life elsewhere. I mean, on a fundamental philosophical level. So we should be open to the possibility that liquid water on rocky bodies is not the only way, it's not the only environment that life can begin or be maintained in. And so again, from a technical philosophical standpoint, it's impossible to generalize from a single example, but we have to try nonetheless. And so in the process of trying to generalize and abstract a little bit away from the specifics of life on Earth, we suggested three components to genesity. One of the components is having a sufficient combinatorial diversity of components. So for a lot of considerations in habitability, it's assumed that you need carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and maybe a few other elements. So habitability already considers like a sort of threshold diversity of chemical elements. In our case, we suggested perhaps there's a generalization of this where instead of just having at least those 5, 6, 7 chemical elements, you just need a diversity of components that's within some window. It's very difficult to compute what that window should be. And that window sits in between a level that's too high and too low. So if you have a very simple situation like the moon, for example, doesn't have a very high diversity of components. So that would seem to be a bit of a constraint. If you're looking for systems which produce emergent learning and complexification, but you just have one or two physical material components, then it seems hard to imagine. I mean, the sort of space of emergent structures that can come from a low diversity set of components is quite narrow and would seem to exclude living systems and evolving systems. So the first component of genesity is having a diverse enough set of components, and that is not restricted necessarily to elements or chemical compounds. So we go a bit broad in some parts of the paper where we suggest, you know, maybe the internet is a genial environment, and so the the basic components could be memes, for example.
Some people have told me that was their favorite part of the paper.
Oh, really?
Talking about the genesity of wow. Cyberspace.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's also been echoed in some other papers that there could be these new sort of Genesis events that we're not aware of happening in a sort of quasi sort of shadow biosphere before our eyes. And then we assume that you also need some free energy, some useful energy, because I think it's very reasonable. I think almost everyone would agree that we do not expect to find life anywhere in an equilibrium system, because equilibrium is associated with stationarity, so no time variation, and homogeneity, so that there are no gradients of pressure or temperature or any internal state variables. So given that we assume life can only exist in and out of equilibrium system, we assume that genial environments have to be away from equilibrium, so they have what we called an energetic driving force in the environment, like a source, at least one source of free energy. And again, we sort of suggested that this shouldn't be too high. Like the sun would be an example of a place where the energetic driving force is so high that it's probably too much, because it's going to produce a lot of turbulence and chaos, and the types of structure, the sort of balance between order and chaos that we associate with life would probably be swamped out by a system that's so flooded with energy like the sun. So the energetic driving force, we assume, lives in some ideal window, which may itself be context dependent, so very hard to calculate. And then the third, and I think probably the most sort of different addition to the habitability concept that we put into Genesity, was the informational driving force. So this has been essentially absent from previous definitions of habitability, because they just focused on the liquid water and the chemical elements and the conditions. So we're sort of suggesting that even if you have an energetic driving force and some good combinatorial diversity of components, if the environment is extremely simple, let's say it has no variability or it's extremely noisy, it's unlikely life is going to be able to emerge. When we look at what life does, almost all of what it does is responding to its environment and solving problems, predicting what the environment is going to do, all kinds of different time scales. I mean, a lot of the function of life and cells is related to homeostasis, keeping cellular integrity, keeping like organismal integrity so that you can survive and reproduce. And that becomes closely related to predicting the environment, because the environment changes. You want your cellular or internal conditions to stay relatively constant. So if there's an environment that's extremely simple, I would not expect any life to emerge, because the physical driving forces from like the energetic driving force would just be dissipated by non-living processes. Basically, I don't see a niche for life in a system that's extremely simple. So we postulate that for life to begin, and also for life to evolve, I don't know about maintained, but certainly for starting life and evolving life, we suggest that the environment has to be in some ideal window of complexity. There have to be problems to solve and sort of challenges to be faced, because otherwise all of the available energy could just be eaten up by non-living processes. Simple sort of dissipative structures like convection cells or chemical reactions and that kind of thing. So those are the three components of Genesity, where we're trying, even though we're against a philosophical uphill struggle, we're trying to sort of generalize the conditions that we see are conducive to the maintenance and evolution of life on Earth, and potentially also to the origin of life on Earth.
I'll remark on the informational driving force, and then I have a question for you about the component diversity. So the informational driving force, this requisite complexity of the environment, really speaks to the theme that we've been talking about life trying to learn, right? Trying to solve puzzles in its environment. If the environment is too bland and boring, you don't incentivize a learning system to take a foothold and to continue to evolve, to learn about the environment in better and better ways. So I feel like that's just such a profound thought that you had as we were developing this term and this concept of Genesity. Now, the component diversity thing is really interesting, because to tie this Genesity paper back to your paper that you did with David about the earliest learning systems, I feel like there was a really fortuitous component diversity there in terms of authorship, where you, a complexity scientist, a physicist, an astrobiologist, original life scientist, met somebody who, you know, was completely outside of our field, but brought a different kind of mindset, skill set, intellect. Talk about how, you know, is that basically a reflection of component diversity helping to drive novelty? What do you think, Stuart?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, this to me is, yeah, the power of serendipity and let's say diversity of connections and random encounters. So yeah, David is possibly the most popular, I haven't checked the numbers, but he may be the most popular French language science communicator on YouTube. So he has a very, very successful YouTube channel and he releases regular videos on all kinds of scientific topics. So he's extremely well informed on a very broad scale of scientific areas. And I mean, my French is not quite good enough to keep up with what he's saying, but I can tell that it's communicated in a very comprehensive but also easy to understand way. So he initially contacted me initially because he was interested in our LOIF concept and wanted to do a video on his YouTube channel about that. So we had a little discussion and he published his video about the LOIF concept. And after we were done talking about that, we sort of had a bit of a chat about the origin of life. And I mentioned that since my PhD, I'd been running various simulations of chemical self-organizing systems. And I had always wondered whether they were capable of also having this associative learning property. But I hadn't really been able to observe that in the simulations that I'd been running up until that point. I was, let's say, at a bit of a stumbling block at that stage. And David, because he's a highly qualified software engineer and game designer, he said, well, that's interesting. I might try coding up your model and adding a few extensions. I'm going to use the Unity framework because that's one of the most popular software packages for designing and building games. And it can really take advantage of GPU. So I think I can code something up and do some experiments. I said, yeah, that sounds awesome. That's, yeah. Let me know how you get on. And, you know, within almost, I think within days or a very short turnaround, he had built a model of the reaction diffusion system. So you have a stimulus coming in that triggers this short-term memory. And then if a second stimulus comes along, the presence of the short-term memory plus the second stimulus triggers the formation of long-term memory over time. So basically, if that keeps happening, if the two stimuli keep occurring together, then you keep getting this buildup of long-term memory. Whereas if one of the stimuli occurs in isolation, then the reaction of short-term memory to long-term memory does not happen. And so we sort of used that as our like basic inspiration. So we had a short-term memory molecule and a long-term memory molecule. And the key feature of our system is this sort of time dependence. So in our case, our system is triggered by like a stimulus and this toxic substance. And it can learn the association between those two such that when this toxic substance keeps occurring and it encounters the stimulus, it can produce an antidote before the toxin arrives and sort of protect itself from the toxin. But it was only once me and David started collaborating and once David produced this framework for simulating these different chemical learning systems that we were able to actually establish that, sure enough, there are some very simple reaction schemes that can not only do associative learning, but you can put them in these reaction diffusion structures that I had modeled. And it turns out you can also embed the associative learning system in those chemical structures, and those structures will survive using that associative learning ability. So we outline some environmental conditions where only the associative learning chemical structures survive and all the others are defeated. And so, yeah, it's been a fantastic collaboration. And we're now working with Sylvia Holler at the University of Trento to try and implement these systems experimentally, because Sylvia is a expert on droplet systems and has done great work on not only the sort of self-organizing behavior of droplet systems, but using droplet systems for medical applications, drug delivery and cancer treatment, that kind of thing. So we're in the process of trying to build those reaction diffusion spots in Sylvia's lab over in Trento. Yeah, so it's been an awesome ride, and I'm very grateful that serendipity and chance blessed us, conspired to help us on the path.
I just love that story of, you know, the serendipity of you and David meeting, and out of that, you know, brand new science, brand new insight into the origin of life. It's just, it's so cool to see that happen.
Yeah.
We're running out of time, Stuart. It's always wonderful to nerd out with you. I have one last question, which brings us now from the origin of life through the 4 billion years or so of evolution of life on Earth. Life has created tremendous novelty, created apparatus to sense stimulus from all sorts of different domains, and learned to learn better over the past 4 billion years, to the point where it has now created technology that can do things that just blow our minds, like ChatGPT.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about artificial intelligence, especially these large language models that have really taken society by storm over the past 2 years or so. Do you see the onset of AI? Do you see entities like ChatGPT as part of life's ongoing evolution and learning and information processing capability? And I just want to hear your thoughts on this, because you think about things through a completely different lens, through this information science lens, and it just seems like we're at maybe an inflection point in life's ability to do information processing and learn. But I want to hear your thoughts. So Stuart, tell me what you think of ChatGPT.
Yeah, it has been a mind-blowing couple of years, and difficult to make sense of, because I normally start from the position of the idea that there are no unique points in history, because we're told almost on a daily basis, and it does feel like we're at a unique point in history. So I often try and compare this point in history with others to try and work out if there's something non-unique about this current point in history. I mean, and it is challenging, to be honest, to not conclude that it is unique. In one sense, I see the AI revolution as being the sort of logical second half of the information revolution, in the sense that before, let's say, the transformer architecture and these really advanced deep neural networks came along, we were drowning in our information, as in the rate at which we were generating data, let's say, because remote sensing has become so cheap and so easy. We all have smartphones. I mean, the internet itself is hungry for information. That's its job, right? And you can imagine there's kind of like an implicit selection pressure for the relationship between us and the internet to converge towards something that generates more information. But at the same time, I mean, let's face it, we were drowning in that information. The rate at which it was being generated and stored was massively greater than the rate at which we were processing it, using it, making sense of it, and actually, yeah, sort of putting it to good use, let's say. So the question is, like, if you have all that data, how do you make sense of it? We cannot make sense of it, because it's the patterns. If there are patterns in that data, they exist in some high dimensional abstract space, which we can't imagine, very difficult for us to theorize, because we evolved to deal with this sort of three-dimensional physical world of mostly Newtonian mechanics. So those constraints are completely absent for machine learning algorithms, for neural networks. So in order to make sense of all that data, so it's a vast quantity of data, we want to process it somehow. And processing, to me, in some ways means compressing. Like, if you want to find some patterns in that data, you are inevitably going to throw away a lot of the information that's there and come up with some compact description. So as an algorithm, the neural network would say, you know, I found some correlations, some small compressed description. I mean, if we think about the size of ChatGPT's training data and the size of ChatGPT itself, that's a huge compression down. And so the machine learning algorithms that we've come up with will give us a set of compressions of all this information that we've generated. And so they will throw away some details and give us actually a smaller picture of what is there. But it has to be like that, because we cannot make sense of all the information. So it's going to find some patterns, give us some guidance on what's in there. So it will help us make sense of this deluge of information that we generated, for better or worse, and for the most part for better. So I think, you know, they will guide us in how we can expand ourselves. So just imagine how much more quickly we can learn with ChatGPT. Like, if you're a student and you're learning about a new topic and you can just have a conversation with it, and okay, it hallucinates sometimes, but a lot of the information is fairly good. So we can already see that ChatGPT is helping us learn much faster. And at the same time, we're helping it learn faster as well. And I mean, my feeling is that on the question of like whether it can do abstract reasoning, you know, it can't, I would agree, it can't do abstract reasoning. It can't generate causal models of, let's say, real phenomena. I am on the side of like, it's a master of language and it's a master of correlating concepts and meanings in whatever embedding space it's come up with. I don't think that necessarily translates into a mechanistic causal understanding of the world. You know, I'm with the sort of embedded cognition people. It probably needs to go into a robot for that to happen.
Mm. Hey, bringing back to Star Trek has always shown us technologies that seemed far future. You know, the 24th century, they're walking around with iPads, and, you know, communication devices that, and, you know, having Skype calls. And I guess for the 1980s and early 1990s, that seemed like far future technology, but it really only took a couple of decades to reach the point in which now in 2024, we're walking around with iPads and having Zoom calls.
Right.
So in what sense is Lieutenant Commander Data an artificial life form just around the corner? Or do you think that that thing will actually take maybe until the 24th century to materialize? Or is ChatGPT a really big step there to making data?
Well, it's a big step for communication for sure. But so we've had in the house a couple of robotic vacuum cleaners. And, you know, there are some situations where these things are quite good, but gosh, do they have problems? I mean... You set it running and it goes, oh, my, you know, my brush is stuck and I'm jammed underneath the chair again. Can you help me? And you just feel like giving up and going and doing it yourself. So when I see robots like Optimus and Boston Dynamics, I mean, they're amazing. But on the other hand, I think, why is my robotic vacuum cleaner so, why does it find it so difficult to just not get stuck on things? So that confuses me a little bit. You know, that gap. So I feel like there's still a gap on the robots, but at the same time, large language models went through this like sigmoidal shift. It was not linear. So I think the robots, it will probably be something similar, but we're definitely not there yet. You know, I'm no expert in self-driving or anything, but I wonder whether the reason it's so hard is because you essentially have to have, you know, a low level model of human cognition. And that is really the challenging part. And my guess is that's probably a good like 10 years away or so. It's a tricky question again of whether when a baby is born and it has a blank cognitive slate and it learns very quickly, and you could ask the question of the information that it ultimately has and the causal understanding of the world, what fraction did it learn by its interactions with the world, and what fraction was kind of implicitly there in the basic structure of the brain? Because the basic structure of the brain has evolved over millions of years. And so it could be that the baby has a huge head start by the architecture of the brain and the sort of embodied nature. So yeah, I'll be curious to see how it goes.
I don't know. The world is changing in so many different ways. And your prediction is data in 10 years. So we'll revisit this in 2034 and see if that's true. It'll probably be robot me and robot you talking avatars. Instead of real me. Yeah.
I mean, because if you look at Back to the Future, we were way off. They thought we'd have fully robotic restaurants and flying cars by 2015, almost 10 years ago. So we really missed all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, no flying cars, no robotic restaurants, but ChatGPT.
Yeah,
it's hard to predict the future. I guess that's the lesson from today, is that it's, despite how good we are at learning and predicting the future, it's still very hard to predict the future. And that's, I guess, the reason why we're here, the reason why evolution continues to be open-ended, right? Because there's still so much more to do.
Yeah.
Our environment is so complex.
Yeah, and it's just impossible to say whether predicting the future creates either self-fulfilling prophecies or divergence, because, you know, you make the Terminator movie and then you avoid it, or you make the Matrix and then you avoid it, or do you make it come true? It's really not clear to me how those two are balanced.
Well, Stuart, thanks so much for joining the podcast once again. Always a pleasure to speak to you about these really heady subjects. We went from the origin of life to your vacuum cleaners today.
Yeah.
And I think that's the mark of a successful conversation.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the vacuum cleaner is definitely not going to be an ancestor of a future new form of life. I mean, it sounds terrible. You know, I may live to regret saying that, but the vacuum cleaner is a humble form of life, I guess, at this stage. Yeah, well, thank you. It was super fun.
Stuart Bartlett is one of the most fascinating thinkers I've ever met. And I owe so much of my success as a scientist and so much of the fun that I have being a scientist to the highly influential conversations that we've shared over the years. I hope you gained a new perspective on life, its origins, and its evolution by listening to today's discussion. On the next full-length episode of Strange New Worlds, we'll be joined by Professor Mary Jane Rubenstein and discuss her book, Astrotopia, The Dangerous Religion of the Corporate Space Race. This is a book that blew my mind and changed the way I process the industrial space age that we're living in right now. Between now and then, look out for some short response episodes to Season 5 of Star Trek Discovery. Discovery is the Star Trek series that spurred me to create this podcast, and I'm sad that it's ending, but so looking forward to what this final story arc has in store for all of us. Until next time, take care, stay curious, and I'll see you out there.
I don't really see any future where either is living in isolation. We won't be able to, it won't be long before we can't survive without something like ChatGPT. And likewise, it can't survive without us. I mean, maybe in the end, there'll be all this stuff happening. The robots and the machine learning algorithms will be doing all this stuff. And the only role left for humans will be to essentially be philosophers and work out why all this is happening. We'll just observe and ponder like what's going on and try and make sense of it.
And hopefully that's a fun life. I think that would be a fun life to just ponder things.